This interview with Patrick Carroll is definitely one of my favorites that I've ever done. I highly recommend you stay tuned. Patrick comes from no money, moved cities at age 19, and got started in real estate investing in the single family space, and then pivoted into multifamily and college housing and property management, and a lot of other vertically integrated companies and services along the way. Millions and millions of dollars made along the way. I think he said by age 27, he'd made close to $10 million. And I think that pales in comparison to where he is now. Just a fascinating story. Very humble guy, and clearly likes to kind of operate behind the scenes. And, I just love the story of, how he's evolved over time. We do talk a lot about how mental health can be really challenged with entrepreneurship, and maybe how to balance all of that, being an entrepreneur with that drive and that work ethic, and how other facets of your life can really suffer with regard to mental health, relationships, et cetera. And it's just really interesting also a lot about market conditions and his insights. He's really able to zoom out and kind of look ahead. And it just feels like he's been able to time the markets well. And if you're just starting out, this one is definitely for you. Also, if you've been in the real estate investing space, this one is for you. Good amount of discussion on single family versus multifamily, but also the personal element of just mindset. A lot about mindset in this discussion. At the very end, he talks about how, I'm not going to give it away, you need to stay tuned, but he gives some very, very good advice at the very end of this show, about how to make it, how to be a success. So you don't want to miss this episode, and you want to listen all the way to the end. I hope you enjoy it.
From adversity to abundance, hosted by entrepreneur and seasoned real estate investor Jamie Bateman, is the ultimate guide for active and passive investors seeking clarity, mental fitness, and the confidence to make inspired decisions in the world of real estate. With a decade plus of investing experience across various niches and a background as a combat veteran, former Army officer, and multi-million dollar mortgage note company owner, Jamie brings a wealth of knowledge and inspiring stories to each episode. Through weekly episodes featuring insightful interviews with industry leaders and solo explorations of mindset and strategy, listeners will uncover actionable advice and tips to overcome challenges and build lasting financial success. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just starting, From Adversity to Abundance is your roadmap to turning obstacles into opportunities and achieving financial freedom.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the From Adversity to Abundance podcast. I am your host, Jamie Bateman, and I'm thrilled today to have with us Patrick Carroll. Patrick is a real estate visionary, entrepreneur, and philanthropist, and we're going to get into his amazing story here in a bit. Patrick, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. I'm told you're not supposed to refer to, prior to hitting record, but we were chatting before we hit record, and man, it's just amazing what you've been able to accomplish. And now you're in a phase of giving back and looking at what's next. So I'm excited to dive in to your story. You came from nothing financially and have certainly reached a level of abundance for sure. Talk to us before we jump back into your younger years. Talk to us a little bit more about what you're up to today.
Yeah, today I'm canvassing the landscape. I'm looking, with interest rates where they are, it really did force everybody to pivot. You're having to look at real estate differently than just financial engineering. I mean, from 2010 to 2020, really, you could borrow it next to nothing. You could buy it 4 or 5 caps, and you'd have great cash flow. We had tons of rent growth in the Sun Belt. And it was, it was a fantastic run. Now you're really having to be a real estate guy again, a real estate investor. You're having to look at properties that are undermanaged, undervalued. They don't have, what their peers, their comps have, and go in there and value add, try to get real rent growth. I think it's difficult to do where the interest rates are. I think the market is still trying to figure out where pricing should be. So I've been paying attention to, and then there's 500,000 units coming online this year. So that's a multifamily. Because it's been tough to figure out, I've looked at other asset classes. Office has been beaten down so much that, if something gets priced down so much, it takes a lot of the risk out of it. Even though office was left for dead, 2 years ago, people are now leasing back. You see big companies and just about everybody having employees come back. I mean, all these tech companies have said, we're going to have work from home forever, have changed their mind. And so it's significant. It's
There's some
a,
opportunity there, right?
I think so. I think there is going to be opportunity, especially for the better located, somewhat newer buildings. Off mark, off center of town, off, not great locations. Older buildings are going to be tougher, but
Sure. No, and clearly you're a real estate guy at heart. I can tell. You're chomping at the bit to get back in the game. I know you're not fully out of the game. Before we jump back, we'll go back to probably age 19 in your story, but you sold off a company a couple of years ago. From a personal standpoint, we don't have to get too specific, but speak to briefly the abundance that you're living in and maybe what you think the listener will get out of this episode.
Yeah, I mean, I started my company roughly when I was 21 years old, and it's all I knew. I worked 24/7, it felt like. I had fire in my belly and I wanted to get it done. I kind of didn't pay attention to anything else, including, health, mental health, relationships. And so, that's hard, but sometimes I think to get to where you want to be, you almost have to have that mentality. I mean, you listen to Elon Musk and he goes into all his companies and say, look, if you're going to work here, you've got to be hardcore. And that's what we were when I had my company. We were all willing to sacrifice, at least temporarily, to do the competition. And I think every stage of your career, whether you're starting out flipping one single family home, which I did, I started doing that. How are you going to get that deal when everybody else, like if it's a good deal, whether it's a small deal or a big deal, you're going to have competition. So how do you get that property? How do you, make sure your subcontractors do what they're supposed to do? How do you get the financing? And it's just, you have to be laser focused. You have to not give up.
Well, and I can tell you're not somebody who looks at this as though you've arrived, but you're living comfortably now, and you're not forced to rush into the next opportunity. It sounds like you're being using some self-discipline and being careful about the direction you're headed in next. But because you've put in all that work and had the success, you're able to take that time now and kind of regroup and make sure the market conditions line up how you want them to. Let's jump back. So age 19, you moved to Atlanta. Start from there, and then we'll walk through your story chronologically. What's going on in your life at age 19?
I mean, yeah, Atlanta was like the New York City of the South. And so, I really just, I wanted to go. I grew up in Tampa, Florida, and I wanted to get out of there. All my friends were going to college. I didn't want to go. And somehow I was able to get 100% mortgage. I remember the mortgage broker, her name was Lisa Pinson, and she got me a whole 100%. First time stated income, all that good stuff in the early 2000s.
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, it's just like if you could fog a mirror, you could get a loan, right?
100%.
Pretty much.
And so I moved up to Atlanta. It was a condo in Midtown Atlanta. And I was like, shit, if I can do this one time, I'm going to do it again. And so I always get first time home buyer. Mortgages were 100%. I probably did it 10 times. And, I had like a little portfolio. I remember going back, on holidays to Tampa and running into buddies that I had from high school and being like, yeah, I own 10 houses. And they were like, what? I started selling them off. Then I started building homes. I would go buy similar homes as I was flipping and knock them down and build bigger homes, and back then you didn't have to have a GC license. So I would just hire crews. I would hire the architects and I'd build the same home over and over and over. I have no idea if those homes are still standing or what. But I got an opportunity. I mean, what's amazing is once you start going, doors open. I tell people once good things start happening, just say yes. And so I got a call. Hey, this guy up in Boone, North Carolina wants to meet with you. And I'm like, Boone, North Carolina, what the hell? So I go up there and it's a guy, he was trying to pitch me on doing mountain homes. And this is like 2006. The housing market, in my opinion, was getting a little long in the tooth. And I said, listen, I don't really want to do that. What else do you have? And he's like, well, this is a great student housing market. And I said, that's what I want to do. And I ended up partnering with him on a student housing development. We sold it in March of 2008, and it was great timing. And shortly after that, the market crashed.
So to on that decision point, that was a key inflection point, if you will. Why was student housing better than the mountain housing option?
My thinking at that time was everybody, well, this guy, first of all, picked me up in a, probably the nicest Mercedes I'd ever seen. He was like 70 years old. And, in addition to saying he was doing student housing, he said, basically, I've made all my money in student housing. But I used to read a ton, I still do, about, real estate moguls, real estate dynasties, things like that. Multifamily was very much a part of all these guys' portfolio. And I'd read about the wealthy families in New York, in New York City and things like that, the Lefracs, all these people. And they all, Donald Trump's father made his money in multifamily. And so I think I had it in the back of my head, but I also just thought, damn, this is the next step up. This is a big deal. I can go back and really thump my chest and, in Atlanta and be a real player, be a real developer.
So your first deal, that first condo, was not necessary. It was an owner occupied. It wasn't meant to be an investment. It was just you wanted to get out of Tampa, and then because you saw how kind of easy it was, and you just wanted to replicate it, right? The first deal actually wasn't intended to be an investment per se, right?
Right. Even though, in addition to getting mortgages, you could hit these properties 2 weeks later with home equity lines. And so I yanked out money on that. I would yank out money on all these things. That's how I was doing the renovation. I'd buy a house, and then 2 weeks later, I'd say, okay, it's worth more. I don't know how they let us do that, and pull up like $12,000. And that's how I'd renovate them. And I'd either rent them or sell them, whatever. I would say buyers, I would say I would market them as both, and if somebody rented it, good. If somebody wanted to buy it,
Also good.
let them do it.
So before you pivoted or I guess moved into the student housing space, what was that timeline, and if you can put any numbers to it, what was the growth like from zero to student housing?
Financially?
Yeah.
All right. I mean, 2004 to probably 2008. And I remember being at, an adult entertainment establishment with my friends from college. And I went
Okay.
to some money, and I had probably, I left the ATM receipt in the ATM machine. I had like $5 million in there. And they were like, what the hell? And so that was like probably 2008. I made a good amount of money on that student housing deal. So really, prior to the financial downturn, Probably close to $10 million.
Wow. And what age was that for you?
Probably like 27.
Wow. So, I mean, for those listening who say, well, this guy just timed the market, got lucky, didn't just happen to not make any mistakes, I couldn't do that. What would you say?
Luck is opportunity met with, when opportunity meets preparation. And so I've been lucky a lot. If you look over my career, I've been lucky a lot. And I acknowledge that, but I've been really good at taking a step back and try to looking 3 to 5 years. I mean, I'm not the guy that wants to get in the weeds and, oversee every part of construction. I'm not the guy that wants to run a big company. I want to hire people to do that. And so I like to take a step back and look at what's going to happen. And I've always taken the approach, it's better to be a little early than a little late. So, yeah, I mean, we're at a time right now. If I was just starting out, we're at another one of those times. Like you and I were just talking about, all this debt is coming due. People got overextended. And so, I'm going to get really active again, I think, in 2026, because I see that as another wave you can ride.
Okay, so take it from age 27, 28. I know once, more recently you've sold off your property management company and hit much higher levels personally. We're not gonna get into too many details there, but walk us through, 27 through where you are today. I know that's a long period of time, but yeah, if you can hit some highlights and some lowlights, because we like to keep it real on this show. I know you came from nothing financially. Walk us through, say, 27 through the next 10 or 15 years.
So in 2009, I ended up buying three property management companies. So, basically, I was looking for deals, anxious to do something, anything. The market had just crashed. And I wanted to start buying distressed apartments. And I started going up to New York, meeting with private equity. And they basically said, look, you're too young, you have no track record, get the hell out of here. And so, I basically would ask them, what would it take for you to partner with me? And he said, listen, we partner with established, fully integrated investment companies, the property management, that do the construction, everything in-house. And so an opportunity came up to buy a property management company, and I bought it. And then he had, this guy had another friend up in South Carolina, and I bought his property management company. And then I bought a third out of bankruptcy. So you look up, in 1 year, I have 20,000 units that I was managing. I didn't have any ownership in them, but I was managing them, something like 700 employees. And, I was going back up to New York, and we looked like a big company, and we were. And so, and I put, I say, I bought a lot of gray hair. I would put these people that had been in the multifamily business for 20 something years on my, pitch deck. And, I was a young guy hiding behind them, essentially. I was the guy out in front. I was the guy finding the deals, doing the networking, things like that. But these people were the ones that were running the day-to-day, creating the value, and they had the experience.
And so by association, you have a lot more credibility. And so, and also you were saying that it sounds like the property management purchases were not the purchasing of those companies. It was not the end in and of itself, right? It was to get to where you wanted to be with private equity in New York. So, how did that all go from there after that first year of running three property management companies?
Yeah, basically, that was liftoff. I mean, I started getting backed. First big deal I did was 222 units. I bought it. After that, I bought a four property portfolio. I think it was something like 600 units in Houston, Texas. And it was just a tear. I mean, we went from, kind of begging to do deals to doing billions of acquisitions a year. unlike a lot of my competitors, I didn't cling to properties. I mean, somebody told me a long time ago a saying, do you want to be king or do you want to be rich? You know, and a lot of these people, you know, would grow their portfolio, buy, 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 buy. Who wanted to be, you know, walk around in town? Atlanta is a big real estate town. Plenty of guys like me. And they would want to go around town and talk about how big their portfolio is. And people would ask me, you know, Pat, what's your goal? What's your goal on how many units you want to have? And I'd say zero. I want to sell them all, you know, that's how I make money. And you know, it's a different model. And you know, I always knew if I made money for my investors, I'm going to make money in my, you know, for myself. And so, you know, again, back to the lucky, you know, getting lucky. I had a model where if I had hit a certain, you know, return, I sold. You know, I didn't keep waiting, keep, you know, bet, you know, betting on things, keep going up, go, keep going up, keep going up. So established relationships with probably 12 of the biggest institutional investors in the country. You know, I'd go up to New York about every 2 weeks. And these guys had no business doing, you know, business with me. I didn't go to college. I was kind of a screw up early on. And they just had to, in a way that I presented things. I presented our company. I presented how we had been successful. I presented on how we had a unique way of finding opportunities. And, you know, I just made it so good, and it's hard to say no. Oh, yeah.
Okay, so and then over the years, did your those three property management companies merge into one, or how did that work?
Yeah, we named it all Carol after me, which was just awesome. You know, I'd go around the country and, you know, you'd walk on these properties and everybody's wearing Carol on their shirt. And so talk about a proud moment. But yeah, we merged those companies. And we got up, the highest we got up to was 1,000 employees. And so we built out, you know, the property management company. I had a construction company and I had a big investment slash acquisitions company. And yeah, they all kind of coexisted together.
Yeah, so you were more vertically integrated, like you said before.
100%. I mean, we did everything from, you know, even an insurance company, renters insurance company. So we really did everything. And I would tell my investors, you know, look, if something bad happens, you're going to call me anyway. So like, I might as well take care of it myself and make sure it's done right.
So it's probably tough to answer, but looking back, how much of the financial success came from the property management directly versus because you had these property management companies, you were plugged into all these other services and other investors, et cetera. Is it possible to even answer that one?
Yeah, I mean, I think the property management company was probably 20%, especially off the sale. But, you know, in real estate, property management is a means to an end. You know, like you said, it really helps you. I'd say it gives you an advantage of information. You're seeing
For
these
sure.
properties and how renters are, you know, reacting. You know how, like we would study income growth. You know, are people in certain cities, you know, making more money? Is their job markets improving? Things like that. So you get information. I was fortunate to sell the property management company for a good amount, but I definitely made more money in buying
Other
and selling.
areas.
Yeah, real
Yeah,
estate.
I was just curious because like my I have some single family rentals in Maryland, and I've been speaking with my property manager a good bit about partnering or buying him out or something like that, and he's been weighing whether this is probably 100 and I don't know 25 150 units, nothing crazy, but
So how you start.
He's got a construction arm that he spends most of his time with, and he's been weighing, which one's better long term. How do I, just so just I think long, what you said is makes so much sense. He's so plugged in more than I am to all these vendors and all these just transactions and everything because of the property management company. He's just got a real advantage there in ancillary services.
I'm out, man. If you got the opportunity.
There you go. So fast forward, say just to wrap up the story, your story, at least up to today. What does age 40 to 45, what did that look like?
Oof. I went through, let's see. So 40, 40 to 40, I guess one was COVID. Nothing really happened. 41 to 43 was massive selling. I felt like, again, kind of what I felt like in 2007, people were paying three caps. People were paying prices that could not hold up. And so I was selling properties as fast as I possibly could and figuring that if it went lower, fine. If I didn't sell at these prices, I would feel like an idiot. And so we sold as much as we could. I'd say 43 to 45, 43, I sold my property management business, which was, I'd say, a relief. I'd had, hundreds of employees for 15 years.
That's a
And
lot. That's a lot of work and a lot of stress.
I took a lot of pride in having, a private business. And, during COVID, I didn't lay anybody off and things like that. So it was a stressful period. And 45, I have been playing a lot of shuffleboard. I've been, no,
Nice.
I have, I haven't been doing much. I read a lot. I research a lot. I want to be as prepared as I can for when the market opens back up, which I think it'll be 2026.
Now I know, we've said a couple of times you came from nothing financially, so you've dealt with adversity there. The show is From Adversity to Abundance, and oftentimes we do branch off into, health adversity or relationship adversity. Looking back on your own story, what would you say, is kind of the biggest, the most adversity? Where was the adversity for you when you look back at your story?
Multiple things. I think adversity, I think I was self-conscious going in, starting to raise capital in New York because, I didn't go to college. All these people had gone to Harvard, Cornell, all these really impressive schools. And it turned out, that was a false assumption, but, I felt that was a hard thing to get through. Building the business, you just, or at least I did, put so much stress and damage, on myself. I think I was stressed every single day. I was barely sleeping. It was just, it was fueled with, unsustainable adrenaline. And so, I found out, recently I struggled with some mental health problems that were probably brought on during that period. They probably helped me, as I get a little older, definitely dealing with some of the ramifications. And so, looking back, I would have at least, instead of 100% of my interest focus on business, maybe 10% on,
Some
making
other.
sure I'm healthy and making sure I'm playing
No,
the
that's good.
long game.
And not to, hijack the episode, but it's on a lesser scale, but I can relate for sure. I was running a loan servicing company that frankly didn't go so well, but it was so stressful for me personally, and I was not, taking care of myself or, just so over the last year, I've just been much more focused on honestly playing pickleball and my own personal health and mental health as well. And it's just been a nice reset period. We've had several episodes specifically about mental health on the podcast, and one was about bipolar disorder and whether or not it can be a superpower. And I know that there's obviously downside, and frankly, we've in my home we've dealt with some real mental health challenges. But and I know there's also a higher rate among entrepreneurs. There's a big crossover between mental health disorders, challenges, conditions, whatever you want to say, and entrepreneurship. And you can probably debate all day long, you know, is it which one came first? Did the business create this mental health condition, or are you prone to be an entrepreneur because you have ADHD? And I'm not labeling anybody here. I'm just throwing that out there.
Well, yeah.
What do you have to say about that, if anything?
Well, I got recently diagnosed with bipolar disorder.
Oh.
So I do think it's, in a way, a superpower. I mean, I look at my 30s and it was just, it was, organized chaos. It was, I look back and I'm like, how did I do that? And again, I think the creativity that comes with it, the ability to kind of strategize, the ability to look out 3 to 5 years, I think that all correlates. I think that's something entrepreneurs can do, all do, successful ones. You have to be able to see around corners, and you have to have, almost unhuman like stamina, and you have to have the appetite to take risk and the the wherewithal. And I think that's all a byproduct. The negatives are, you can hit walls people don't experience, right? So the highs are higher and the lows are lower. And a lot of people throughout, when they're dealing with it, self-medicate in unhealthy ways and things like that. The good news is there's just a lot of advancement, a lot of knowledge around it. And a lot of openness. I mean, just the fact that we're talking about it, the way I grew up,
No, we wouldn't talk
hell
about
no,
no.
hell no.
No. I mean, right. I a while back interviewed a guy who was a business coach for me on this show, and we talked a lot about mental health as well. And yeah, we were actually lacrosse buddies back in college, and he's a little bit older than I am. But it hit me during that episode that there's no way we would have been talking about breath work that we both do. You know, it's like I would have been laughed off the field if I brought that up with
Take your
somebody. But
shirt off.
exactly. So, you know, I do think there's a there's a, an extreme to either side, which isn't good, where you can end up focusing on, you know, somebody's mental health challenges too much, and you can get stuck there, right? But to not acknowledge it or pretend that it's not real, or you're just weak because you know, you're depressed or something, it's just ridiculous. So I think we've come a long way. There's so much they don't know though, and you know, just we're just scratching the surface as far as knowledge goes. But this is another, you know, 5 or 6 episodes we could have on this topic. So but yeah, I mean, sounds like you looking back, you know, you do think there's a necessary, there's a requirement, you know, for an extreme amount of focus on the business and that drive and that work ethic. And you're not saying, you know, everything should be always balanced, you know, 100% balanced in your life, but don't go so far to the extreme where you're causing serious mental health damage or physical health challenges. Is that fair to say?
It's fair to say it's hard to do,
Right. A lot of this on this show, it's easy to talk about, right? But hard to do.
I always thought, if my competitors weren't working on the weekends, I was going to be working on the weekends. If they were not working over the Christmas holiday, I'd be working over the Christmas holiday. Like, I always wanted that edge, and I think it, just for my own mental, mentality, I wanted to know I was outworking them. I wanted to know that, when it came to compete, I was better prepared.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got some questions to run through, but before we get there, talk about some of the philanthropy and mentorship that you're involved with.
Yeah, I've been heavily involved with the Boys and Girls Club. Last year we did a $1 million shoe giveaway, which was, $100,000 of shoes in 10 different cities, which was awesome. I mean, you got to see these young kids get a pair of Jordans, get a pair of awesome shoes, and versus, just donating some money and not knowing where it goes. You got that instant gratification, which was a lot of fun.
That's great.
I've done, various charities from, special needs. And I mean, I've supported a lot. I've even supported Israel, which is important. I think, the whole world needs help, and I, if you just get too focused on, what's in your wheelhouse, you leave out a lot of things. And so even mental health, I mean, I've thought about doing a lot of charity around that. And so, but I think just going back and on a mentorship, I mean, via my Instagram, I have over 1 million followers. At least 2 or 3 times a week, I'll answer, people will DM me, hey, can I talk to you for 20 minutes or whatever? And I'm happy to do it. It's a fulfilling, feeling. It's something that, frankly, I was able to get when I was coming up. I would meet with guys. I would look up what I thought was the most successful guy in town and reach out to him. Hey, can I have a cup of coffee with you? Hey, and they said yes. And it's like these kids are shocked when I say yes, or somebody DMs me and I respond or whatever. And it just, one, it's, I'm a humble guy. It's like, holy, these guys, and people come up to me and it's like, wow, you were nice enough to say hi. I'm like, why would I not be? I'm like, I'm so fortunate. And I still feel like I'm this 20-year-old guy just getting started, not this old ass man, but it's that's the mentorship to me is probably the biggest thing. One thing to stroke a check, it's another thing to give your time. And
Absolutely.
it's hard to say which one's more important. I mean, you can certainly help a lot of people, and I think the next generation is so important. So you can give wisdom versus, again, stroking a check. Or I'm not the biggest proponent for college. I mean, if you look at a lot of the intelligent thought leaders in this country, Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, this, that, whatever, they're saying it's not needed. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't be educated. And giving education away that's meaningful, I think is important.
Absolutely. That's really good. I thought all, real estate investors were greedy and penny pinchers, but I guess there are a couple good guys out there. No, all kidding aside, I think it's just we need to promote that more and just talk about how doesn't have to be real estate investing, but successful, capitalists, you can say, or entrepreneurs actually often want to give back and do give back. And you're adding value constantly. So, I just think that's something we need to celebrate more. You ready for some more rapid fire questions here, Patrick?
Sure.
What's one thing that people misunderstand about you?
But I'm a nice guy.
So you are a nice guy or you're not a nice
I am a nice guy.
guy? And they think you're not. Gotcha. And that's just from the vibe you put off, or why do you think they think that?
Maybe the vibe I give off, also, I think the pre-thought out motion that, like you said, real estate guys have elbows and things like that.
Gotcha. What's one of your biggest failures and what did you learn from that experience?
Probably my divorce. I got divorced when I was 40. And that's a failure all across the board. I mean, even if you're better off separated or whatever, it has an impact on your kids, it has an impact on everyone. And just the way I reacted, it's my reaction was not the best. So that was probably the worst.
Gotcha. If you could go back and give your 18-year-old self some advice, what would that be?
Get ready for it. It's coming. And I used to see myself in the, I visualize who I wanted to be. I wanted to be this successful guy in this business, in a suit and be re well respected and this, that, whatever, do big deals. And I would say just get ready. It doesn't matter how you're going to get there, you are going to get there. Just keep pushing.
Nice. Now, for some guests, this question is a big number, and for others, it's not so big. But if you were given $10 million tomorrow, what would you do with that?
Stick it in bonds right now, 5%, just you can get money market 5%. But I would be looking, I would be looking at smaller deals. I wouldn't do one deal. So maybe I'd do 10 deals that, needed $1 million in capital per deal if I was just getting started. If it was me personally, I would be looking at doing something I've already done, multifamily, things like that. I would be looking for 7% going in on cash flow. And if I couldn't find that, I would be, I'd be patient. And so, that's the thing. It's, number one rule of investing is don't lose money.
That's really good. So for someone starting out in their career, they want to do real estate investing. They're not sure what niche to go into. They're somewhat aware of current market conditions, but they don't have a lot of capital, but they've got time and energy. What advice would you give to them right now?
Start out in the single family market. Housing is, look, housing's like the biggest business in the country, not the world. Somebody told me a while ago, you can't create a virtual house or a virtual place to live. If you look at office market, we're sitting on Zoom right now. That's done virtually. Shopping can be done virtually. You can't create a virtual living environment. So housing's always going to be here, whether it's single family residential, multifamily, whatever. So if you don't have a lot of capital, but you can bring a lot of hustle, a lot of value to the table, find people that have idle capital and want that. There's a lot of idle capital. There's a lot more capital than there is hustle and deal flow. And so I think you have to be creative though in that first deal. The first deal is always the hardest. Don't try to do a $50 million deal right out of the gate. Start with this couple single family. By the way, the business model on single family investments is the same on 100, 200 unit multifamily deals.
Just a
Just,
couple more zeros.
that's right. So,
Gotcha.
yeah.
Okay, so in the single family space, like fix and flip, or I know every situation's different. There's no one size fits all answer, but I now know I want to go single family real estate investing. What do I do?
I like to fix and flip, and I would stay in a market that's not, in a price bracket that's not above $1 million. So I would want to be, what I always did in my apartments was I didn't want to be in the bottom 10%. I didn't want to be in the top 10%. So I would look at where 80% of the people, or less, I'd look and try to refine where I want to, where the most people can buy at, especially in today's interest rates. And that's where I'd be targeting. So, where, and I'd focus really on locations, best school districts. I'd want to be the cheapest house in an expensive neighborhood or something like that.
How do you define mental fitness in the context of real estate investing? We've talked about this some, but speak to that briefly.
I can tell you how I got to where I am, and you have to be the craziest guy in the room. You have to, because it's an aggressive business, and you have to be willing to, stand up for yourself. And I said crazy. It's just you have to be aggressive. You have to be willing to not back down. You have to be, and even if that's not yelling and whatever, even if it's keeping to yourself, but just knowing. These people are trying to outsmart you. These people are trying to win, and you be like that. I think you also have to realize that, that give yourself self-confidence, put in the work. And if you've prepared, the right way, feel confident.
Yeah, I've heard I guess guidance, or the principle that reps. Lots of reps lead to competence, which leads to confidence. So,
Right.
start with one deal, like you said, and create that momentum. Then you put in reps and keep doing it. And then you realize I am good at this, and that you build more confidence, and it kind of feeds itself. In the real estate investing space, whether commercial, residential, whatever. What is one thing that you see right now that's controversial out there that people should avoid?
Overpaying, forcing deals. I mean, forcing deals are when your gut tells you this thing doesn't work, when you're the numbers don't look good, but you just do it just to do it. Never ends well, happens a lot. I see a lot of people online, I don't want to name names, they're raising a lot of capital online, that's controversial to me. It's, when you raise a bunch of money, even though, the market's not, attractive to be investing in, you have a gun to your head to put it to work. You owe investors returns, so you're highly incentivized to do deals, whether they make sense or not. And so to me, that never ends up well. I will certainly be back in the investing game, whether I raise, money, that way, or whether I go back to partnering with big institutions, but I just, it's not the right time. There's 500,000 units being delivered this year. That's going to hurt the market a lot, at least from a rent growth time, standpoint. So whenever I see a lot of people rushing to do deals, it just makes me wonder about their motivations.
Gotcha. Makes a lot of sense. All right, as we wrap up here, Patrick, how has financial abundance made your life better?
A lot of ways. I mean, it's given me the ability to give back. It's given me the ability to live a really nice life, to kind of be able to step back and have patience. I think I never really had that before. I think, I still feel like I'm broke. I wake up every morning and feel broke. And I think that's a good thing. I don't, as much as people want abundance, and I used to read books on abundance and Deepak Chopra and try to, getting abundance. As much as you like, I know I don't want to, I want to keep wanting. I don't want to, lay around and feel like I'm set. I still want to keep that hunger. Now, obviously I don't want to give away the money that I had, all of it. But, waking up and staying hungry and looking for that next opportunity and things like that is what I want. I don't want to feel like I've already made it and, I've got nothing left to prove and I'm cruise control. I don't want that.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. And it's probably wouldn't be good for your physical health, mental health, et cetera, or those around you if you just kind of coasted the rest of your life, right? What is a book or two that you could recommend?
Let's see. Sam Zell's book is great. It says it's got something to do with bullshit. It says something about bullshit. And then Gerald Hines's book, or Trammell Crow. I'm going to say Trammell Crow's book. Somebody should read that for sure. And somebody starting right out is Cash Flow or Robert Rich Dad Poor Dad.
Yeah, I know. I do like Cash Flow Quadrant. The Sam Zell book, is that Am I Being Too Subtle or is that a different one? Yeah.
I think that one works.
Okay. Gotcha. Well, that was a good list right there. What is one question, Patrick, that I have not asked that you wish I had?
Let's see here. You gotta be okay with being, not part of the crowd. Meaning, like, if you're part of the crowd, if if you're just doing everything everybody else does, how are you going to be successful? And so, when I was getting my business really, it was growing significantly. Everybody in the real estate business went to the same country club. They all, were buddy buddy, this, that, whatever. I was kind of an outlier. And I would say, I don't want my competitors to know everything about me. I wanted to be a competitor. So I think even when you're starting out, your friends and family are going to question what are you doing? Oh my God, yeah, right. He's going to be an entrepreneur. Oh my God, he's going to be real estate mogul, blah, blah, blah. Have thick skin, don't care, and especially as you grow, 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 there's going to be jealousy. And so
Mm-hmm.
you have to be comfortable in your own skin. You have to be, improving yourself. I improve a little bit every day.
Yeah.
And that's what I would say.
That's really good. If you're not getting some type of friction or people asking questions or conflict even in your life, maybe you're not going against the grain enough and thinking differently, and you're gonna end up as just like everyone else, right?
Worst thing in the world for me would be to be average,
Yeah, got it. Now, this has been fantastic, Patrick. Really, really good. I'm just so thankful you've been able to spend time with us. So, this is one I'm definitely going to listen to again for sure, because there are a lot of gold nuggets in this one. Patrick Carroll, anything else you want to add before we hop off?
No, for real estate investors that want to continue to get information like this, my
Yeah.
Instagram just spelled out just like my name, Patrick Carroll.
Yeah, okay. That was my final question is, where can our listeners find you online? So Instagram is the main place, it sounds like. Any other ways to reach out to you?
Not right now.
Got it. Makes sense. All right. Well, thank you so much. Wish you the best of luck. And yeah, I'd love to have you back on in the future when when you've kind of gotten back in the game, so to speak, a little more, and see where you're what the future looks like for you from there. So
Sounds good.
thanks. Thank you so much, Patrick. And to the listener, thank you for spending your most valuable resource with us. And that is your time. Take care, everyone.
Thank you for joining us on From Adversity to Abundance. We hope today's episode has equipped you with valuable insights and practical advice to elevate your real estate journey. For more inspiring stories and resources, visit us at www.adversity2abundance.com. If this episode has inspired you, please share it with a friend who could also benefit from our conversation. Together, let's turn adversity into abundance. Until next time, keep building your mental fitness and your real estate empire.
All right, here's the deal. You work hard for your money. Isn't it about time you put your money to work for you? If you are an accredited investor, check out LabradorLending.com. Our Integrity Income Fund provides monthly cash flow from an investment backed by hard physical real estate. Our income fund, which is uncorrelated to publicly traded stocks and bonds, invests in first lien mortgage notes diversified by geography, property value, and borrower type. So you're not investing in one project. You're investing in a diversified portfolio of first lien mortgage notes. Our Integrity Income Fund aims to pay its investors monthly distributions at a preferred rate of return of 8% annually. Possibly the best part, though, the fund showcases a short 12-month commitment. So you can invest your capital today and have access to that capital in 1 year. Check it out today, LabradorLending.com.